those boys are in the big school. I'm 10 3/4.
Annie exhaled a long plume of smoke and blew a perfect, elegant circle.
Anyway, they took me up by the old pit winding machines and let me have some buckfast.
Did you not tell Father Barry? The police would jail them for that.
No.
She stubbed the doubt and laid her head on the bed, calmer now.
It wasn't worth it, though. Buckfast's pure minging.
Shuggy was shocked at her nonchalance. He was thinking about his mother again, here in this tin box, with Annie's father and his nicotine fingers. He knew she would hate it here, but still she had come. A swift rage possessed him.
Why did you do that?
He spat out at Annie.
Why do girls always let boys do what they like?
Her lilac-coloured pony had been prancing in dainty circles. Now Annie sat back from the playthings, and she was, for the first time that afternoon, lost for words. Outside, the German Shepherd started barking. Shuggy felt the whole caravan tilt as the dog rose and skittered off the front stoop.
Oh, for fuck's sake! Rambo! Rambo!
Annie bounced over the bed and out of the tiny bedroom. There was a great commotion in the caravan park as a dog met with another, and they fell upon each other with squeals and gnashing teeth. Shuggy didn't want to be there anymore. He didn't want to be pretending it was okay to be playing with girls' toys or touching the dirty bits of boys in secondary school. He didn't want to be anything like the lemonade girl. He didn't want to be like Agnes. He wanted to be normal. He rose to his feet and picked up his bag. Annie was roaring at Rambo to let go of the other dog. He could hear the fast gibberish of the racing blare from the telly. Shuggy didn't want to think of Agnes here. He didn't want to think of the nicotine-coloured man pawing at her, and then her plaiting Annie's hair for a warm can of special brew. It made him angry, so he unzipped his school bag and put two ponies inside. Every weekday, before the last bell, Shuggy's guts would tighten, and he would raise his hand and ask most politely to be excused. Dull-faced Father Ewan would inwardly curse the little boy who seemed regular as clockwork. At first he would ask the boy to wait, just wait the extra 15 minutes till the school day was finished. Shuggy, always biddable, would nod with a wince and sit cocked slightly to the side, looking to be in genuine, desperate need. His wincing and huffing would soon start to distract the other children, and the father would acquiesce. Later, in the staff room, the soft-middled father would joke about what this miner's diet of boiled cabbage and ground mince might do for the clergy. The polite little boy, the only one who clearly knew the difference between may I and can I, had been getting the cramps at 3:15 almost every afternoon of the school year. Father Ewan had come to set his watch by it. So Shuggy would spend the last minutes of the school day sat on the low toilet. He would take his trousers down, only to be safe. But he came to know it was only indigestion. It was the burning bile of anticipation, the rising fear of what might lie at home. Agnes had gotten sober many times before, but the cramps had never really completely gone away. To Shuggy, the stretches of sobriety were fleeting and unpredictable, and not to be fully enjoyed. As with any good weather, there was always more rain on the other side. He'd stopped counting a while ago. To have marked her sobriety in days was like watching a happy weekend bleed by. When you watched it, it was always too short. So, he just stopped counting. The boy could not remember the change in himself. At what point the cramps died away and things became different was unclear. He could remember coming home from school one Friday in November and standing outside the house as he always did. Every small detail of the house told of what lay within. This evening, the curtains were drawn tight against the cold and the lamps were on.
His stomach lifted in hope. Shuggy opened the front door a crack, just enough so he could hear the hum of the house. He knew what to listen for. Wailing and crying foretold a bad night. She would want to hold him in her arms and tell him bad stories of the men who had broken her. If there was a sound of country guitars and sad, melancholy singing, then the warm moistness of shit would start to wet his underpants. To hear his mother on the telephone was not always a bad sign. He had to creep in between the front door and the draft door to listen very closely to the tone of her voice, push his ear against the cold, dimpled glass, and hold his breath. She didn't have to be crying or screaming or slurring her words for the drink to be in her. It could still be there. It made her overly polite. A false Mogai accent full of long-syllabled words. Her lips would pull away from her front teeth, and she would use words like certainly and unfortunately. These were the worst sounds to hear. Agnes was mourning her losses, but still too far from unconsciousness. She would sit him down and tell him her stories, only this time she would be angry and not sad. With a packet of half-smoked cigarettes beside her, she would glide her finger through the phone book and make him dial the telephone numbers that she read out. 554-6339. Holding the receiver in his hand, the boy would listen to the chirp-chirp and hope that no one would answer. He grew ashen as a voice came on the other line. "Hello?" said the stranger.
Oh, hello. I'm terribly sorry to bother you.
Agnes would nod her approval from the armchair.
I am looking for someone called Mr. Cam McCallum.
Who? Asked the voice.
Cam McCallum, repeated the boy. He lived in Denniston between 1967 and 1971. He was a bus conductor in the East End, going between George Square and Shettleston. He had a sister named Renee, who married a man named Jock.
The voice, confused at this oddly detailed information, would say,
Sorry, son. There's no Cam McCallum who lives here.
I see. Thank you very much, sir. I am sorry to have bothered you.
Agnes would hiss with disgust from the front room and make him phone the next McCallum in the book. It was worse when they found who Agnes was looking for. The man on the other line would say,
Who is this? I'm Cam McCallum. What do yous want?
The boy's heart would sink.
Oh, I see. Could you please just hold on for a minute, Mr. McCallum? I am transferring your call.
Agnes's eyebrows raised incredulously.
Is that him?
The boy would cup his hand over the receiver and nod.
Right, she said,
taking up her mug of lager and a fresh packet of cigarettes. He would hand the telephone to her like an obedient secretary, and Agnes would arrange herself as if Mr. McCallum could see her through the phone. With a fresh cigarette between her long fingers, she would lift the receiver to her mouth.
You bastard,
she hissed as an introduction.
Hello? Who is this?
Answered the man.
You dirty fucking whoremaster of a bastard.
The man would hang up eventually. He always did. Agnes would take a long draw on her cigarette, then a long pull on the old tea mug. She would stab the redial button on the telephone and smile as it quickly connected her.
Don't you hang up on me. Don't you dare fucking hang up on me.
Who the fuck is this?
Did you think you could get away with it? Eh? The things you did to that young lassie. You bad bastard. There's not a bleeding heart in you, is there?
Cam McCallum would hang up again, and if he were wise, he would wrench his telephone from the wall. Agnes slid her finger through the phone book like it was a menu, looking for something to fill her hunger. She moved on alphabetically,
to the very next man who'd wronged her. Brendan McGowan.
Now wait till I tell you about this scunner.
She turned to Shuggy with the receiver crooked under her chin.
Losing me was the biggest mistake he ever made.
She could sit at the telephone table until it got dark. Then she could sit there in pitch blackness. The end of a lit cigarette was her only light. Shuggy sat next to the electric fire listening to her roar. He was afraid to switch on any lights, hoping the dark would make her sleepy, worried the light would draw her to him like a moth. All this in mind, Shuggy crept home from school and listened carefully at the draft door, hoping that she would not be crying or listening to country music or sitting ready for battle at the telephone. Even the hum of silence could set his guts twisting again. He had heard it once and had believed in it, the deafening hiss of nothing. He had crept into the house to listen closer, believing it was good news, and had let his hands fall from his tight sides. Agnes was there on the floor, in her tight black skirt, in her good winter coat. She was kneeling like she was praying, but the backs of her hands were soft against the linoleum, her head fully in the big white council oven. The sound of nothing had been a trick. The hiss of silence was only the thick gas carrying her away. After that, he'd learned not to trust the quiet. As far as the good sounds went, the sounds of a busy kitchen were the best to hear. The slurp and shake of the washing machine, metal spoons in the sink, and the sound of soup bubbling in big pots. On these days, he would stand happily in the hallway and wipe the condensation from the Artex walls till she found him standing there, half stupefied with contentment, his fingers drawing wet patterns on the white plaster. Other than the McAvennies, the worst bullies at school always seemed to come from houses where father still had work. Their food was microwaved or breadcrumbed, foil-wrapped and individually sized. Their parents were younger and let their children eat what they liked and when they liked. They teased the children who ate stovies and mince. They would hold their noses and tell them they smelled like rotten cabbages. When they said this to Shuggy, he buried his face in the arm of his school jumper and breathed in deep. The boiled cabbage and ham hock, the potatoes and lamb mince, to him, it was a comfort, and he felt lucky to have it on him. There were days when he would come home and hear another voice in the house. He would need to creep along the hallway till he could be very sure who it was. Nice people had stopped visiting a long while ago. The longer his mother had stayed in Pithead, the more likely it seemed the visitor was a bad person. Amongst the worst were the Pitt uncles, nervous, jerking men with thin hair that always seemed wet. They would come to see how she was coping without a man. They would bring bars of chocolate and plastic bags full of lager cans, and they would keep their jackets on indoors. Shuggy knew being home from school was a disturbance to their bad plans. Occasionally an uncle, if hopeful of getting his feet under the drop leaf table permanently, would feign an empty interest in the boy while pushing chocolate bars across the ash-covered table to him. The man would ask, "How is he doing at school? Did he not like to play outside?" As the boy got older, they stopped doing this, stopped smiling at him with the face of Fagin. Now that he was 10, they saw him almost as another man, and they sat with petulant scowls that said Shuggy was ruining their dirty plans. If there were unopened lager cans, then Agnes would make Shuggy sit next to the men on the couch. She would lean back and squint through the cigarette smoke, watch them shift uncomfortably. Between mouthfuls of lager, she would study them as if they were curtains in a bedspread, and she were trying to find a matching set. She told the men how bright her hue was or how well he was doing in school. They would listen and nod and see their plans to jump his mother in the afternoon slip away.
Some had spent quite a lot of money getting her just the right level of pliable. Now they were blocked from a clumsy, sweaty fuck in front of the after-school cartoons. The returning uncles wised up. They would bring cheap footballs, plastic kites, all toys meant to take Shuggy outdoors. The truly desperate would hand over a greasy pile of coins, suggesting to Shuggy, "Take yourself to the pictures for an hour." Shuggy would look blankly at the clammy men and drop the greasy coins in his school bag like a bus conductor, say thank you politely, and turn on the noisy television. This happened only if they were still in the living room by the time Shuggy came home. If they were already in her bedroom, then the boy didn't get any money, and no one bothered to ask him what he wanted to be when he grew up. As bad as these uncles were, they were interested only in his mother. To Shuggy, the aunties who came to visit were often worse. It was like Agnes's worst qualities went out and found a friend. He would be forced to babysit both women as they descended noisily into drunken oblivion, huddled over ashtrays, sharing the last of the doubts and cursing the men that had brought them so low. Unlike the men, they would talk and talk and talk. These sunken-faced pit aunties appeared at the door most mornings like feral cats. Even after a 5-day stretch of sobriety, they had the power to drag Agnes back into the drink. It was like they could hear her shakes from the other side of the housing scheme and would oblige at 9 in the morning with a cheap carry-out. If that day Agnes had the conviction to be sober, they would sit down and drink in front of her anyway. Misery loved company, and her eyes were soon greedily on the plastic bag by their feet. If Shuggy was home from school, he wouldn't let the women in. Even before the first postman had come, they were there with heavy bags in hand. At the front door, they looked almost like good people, but he knew better. He tried to politely push them back down the stone stairs many times. He would lock the door, and they would call through the letterbox, "Is your mammy no home?" and plead, "I've just come over for a wee cup of tea." He wanted to stick forks through the opening into their thin faces as Agnes lay broken inside the house, her bones shaking, guts calling out for a taste of warm lager. Like a cold draft, they always pushed in. They waited till they heard the morning bell, to be sure he would be gone. When he crept back through the door at 4 o'clock, they smiled triumphantly at him. Auntie Jinty was the worst of them. She would pester Shuggy for a kiss as he came in the door from school. The boy could feel her warm tongue against his cheek like a piece of fatty stewed beef. On damp days, Agnes made him rub the little woman's hard feet. Years of the drink had eaten her features, but they spread even thinner in grimacing pleasure as her sour little feet wriggled in her brown tights. She never gave him money. Jinty hated Shuggy because his presence guilted Agnes into periods of dryness. If it wasn't for him, they could have left the shores of sobriety behind and forever sailed a sea of special brew.
"What class are you in now?"
she asked once, her feet in his hands.
"Primary 5,
said Shuggy, keeping his eyes on Jinty. She turned to his mother. She still had her headscarf on.
"Well, it's a bit late, Agnes, but you know, I think there would still be time to make a difference."
"Time for what?"
he asked, rubbing at her bunions.
"To get you into Oor Louise's school."
The boy flashed a startled look. He flicked his eyelashes at her and drew his brows down.
"Oor Louise is a right spazzy."
As soon as he said it, he knew it was unkind. Jinty pulled her foot from his hand and leaned forward in the soft chair. She uncurled a long, knuckly finger and shoved it into his chest. Her face was sore-looking, and Shuggy knew her husband hit her.
Agnes had said as much. As she spoke, her bottom lip looked like it might burst.
Our Louise has special needs, and her school has donkeys. Does your school have donkeys?
No.
Well, I think you should go to her school because it has donkeys.
She took a satisfied tug on the foamy beer.
Mammy, tell her I'm not a spazzy. I don't need donkey school.
His voice was whining and threatening to break. He did not take his eyes from Jinty. Agnes's eyes were closed, and a lit cigarette was slipping from her hand. Beer sloshed onto her lap in big raindrops. Jinty saw her opportunity and went on with a false smile.
There'll be lots of other children just like you. You'll make lots of friends and get good hot lunches and hot dinners.
I have friends, he lied.
It's a big adventure because you get to stay overnight and come home on Friday nights just for the weekend.
Shuggy had seen the special bus drop Louise off on Friday night. He had seen the McAvenny boys throw stones at it as it drove by. He knew Louise vaguely. She was quiet like Leek. He had also seen how she looked happier on a Sunday than she did on a Friday.
Look, it'll be good. You won't be so different anymore.
Jinty turned to Agnes, who was slipping into the noisy sleep of an old man.
That's it, Setty, Agnes.
She nudged his sleeping mother.
Tomorrow I'll call the school and Shuggy can go straight into our Louise's class.
Jinty lifted her foot again and thrust it back into his lap. Shuggy knew in truth that Louise was only a wee bit slow. Neglect had made her shy and withdrawn, and that made her always a half beat out of step, which the pit took to be funny acting. Bridie Donnelly had said that Jinty was just selfish. The special school got Louise away throughout the term and allowed Jinty to dedicate more time to raising her favourite child, Stella Artois. Agnes said later that by the time she realised what was happening, Shuggy had Jinty on the floor and her St. Christopher medallion was broken at the lock. When Leek later asked him what had happened, the boy could only remember twisting her big toe till it cracked. He had wrenched and twisted until her knee buckled and she fell screaming for mercy out of the chair. After that, Shuggy said, everything just fell away. It was like when you look through binoculars, but from the wrong end. Shuggy listened at the front door out of habit. As he walked up the long hallway, he could feel the walls wet with cabbage sweat and the condensation from tea kettles. He slipped like a ghost deeper into the house till he saw her standing in the kitchen doorway, re-wrapping a block of soft white lard. Her hair was soft, white roots shining below the black dye. Her face was free of makeup. As she wrapped the lard, she was looking out the little window above the sink onto the miles of marshlands. She looked peaceful. He straightened tall at last, and the pain went from his bowels. She saw him then in the shadows of the hall. He went to her, and she placed her arms around his head and pulled him close to her soft stomach. Shuggy wrapped his arms around her, and she buried her face in his soft black hair.
You smell just like fresh air, she said, cupping his cold cheeks and kissing them gently.
You smell like soup, he said.
Charming. Away, take your uniform off. I'll bring you some tea.
You will?
She chased him from the kitchen. The living room was cosy and smelled like hot hoovers and lemon furniture polish. The electric fire was on, and the big curtains were drawn against the cold scheme outside. He turned on the TV, and the meter at the top flashed that they had 6 hours left before they needed more 50-pence pieces. It was pure luxury. Standing on the back of his shoes, he kicked them off, shook out of his school trousers, and unbuttoned the white shirt.
The clothes fell about him onto the floor, where he left them in a melted pile. He sat in the middle of the big square coffee table in his clean underpants and stared open-mouthed at the afternoon shows. Agnes came in with a mug of hot tea and a small plate, which she set in front of him.
"What's this for?" he asked. "It's for you," she said.
Shuggy looked at the golden apple turnover and slowly reached out a single finger to touch it. He could feel the heat come off it. She had put it and the tea plate in the oven to warm them through. The pastry was brown and flaky, and all over the top were little white crystals of hard sugar that had melted and made a crispy, sweet-looking shell. On each side of the pastry was hot, sticky golden applesauce, oozing out onto the plate in bubbling clumps. The turnover made a happy, crisp, crackling noise under his finger. The boy looked down at the plate blankly. He worried he could hardly eat it, as his stomach was doing something that felt like the fear cramps. This time, instead of the choking sourness, something bubbled inside him like yellow sunshine. A smile broke inside him, and lifting his stocking feet, he rocked back on his tailbone and spun and spun and spun on his backside until the little tea table was shiny with delight. Agnes had chosen the Dundas Street meeting in the hope that she would not know anyone there. She had tried AA meetings from time to time, but they had never taken. She would be looking around the fellowship at the broken men and women as the shame rose inside her. In the daylight, she would have crossed the street just to avoid these people. Even though her attendance was spotty, the East End group she sometimes went to had started feeling small and overly familiar. Agnes had made a mess of it. Most of the older men had visited her in Pit Head, and she was starting to see familiar parts of herself in the faces of the drawn, nervous women. It was getting harder to deny she was like them. So, one night, Agnes stayed on the bus, past the familiar meeting rooms, and continued on to Dundas Street. It was a fresh start, she had thought, and hopefully, a better class of alcoholic. The Dundas Street meeting was in the city centre between the Queen Street train station and the Buchanan bus station, and as such, pulled in a fairly wide congregation. The sandstone building had been a once grand trade merchant's office, but through changes in the 60s, came to resemble a poorly run primary school. It was long ago stripped of its ornately carved mouldings and suffocated under dowdy brown council paint, strip lighting, and peeling linoleum. To Agnes, it looked very anonymous. The Dundas Street AA had a cheap, long-standing lease on a high-ceilinged meeting room. A slightly raised stage at the front of the room was set with a folding table and six plastic chairs lined up behind it. To the left were a smaller antechamber and a thin corridor where an urn and biscuits were kept. It felt transient, but the regulars tried to make it homely and comfortable, with calendars and postcards sent from Lourdes, from Rome, from Blackpool. Agnes put Shuggy to bed early and then caught the bus into town, not sure whether she would make it to a meeting or, as she had done before, turn herself toward a bingo hall in the Gallowgate. It took all she had to climb the Dundas stairs, and when she walked through the door, she was relieved not to see a familiar face. The air was thick with cigarette smoke. People shifted nervously in their seats, each a respectable distance from his or her neighbour. There was an almost constant chorus of racking coughs and sticky wet phlegm. It felt less cosy than the other meetings. People nodded and smiled politely to each other, but there seemed to be less connection, more of the anonymity she craved. She sat an unobtrusive distance from the front, and could feel the eyes burn on the back of her head. She was overdressed in her long mohair coat, but she was more comfortable that way. A group of people who had been talking quietly in the corner took to the 6 chairs at the table on the stage. A handsome silver-haired man stood up from behind the table. His eyes were deep and brown, and his brow stood out in a thick, pronounced line. Despite the nerves and shakes within her, Agnes could not help but feel a thrill.
"Hello," he began in a booming voice. "Thank you for coming to the Tuesday night group. For those of you who don't know me, my name is George, and I am an alcoholic. I've been at Dundas Street for, nearly 12 years now. I'm encouraged by the amount of familiar faces I see tonight in the crowd, and as always, I am also saddened by the amount of new ones."
He rested his thick knuckles on the table.
"We also have some old friends on the top table tonight, and one or two new ones."
The people to his left and right shifted and smiled.
"Before I introduce them to you, let us start by taking a moment and asking the Lord for help."
The man lowered his head. His hair shone like Christmas tinsel. Agnes squinted at him then for a better look. The room moved as one, as heads rolled forward and eyes closed for the Serenity Prayer. Agnes knew it by heart. None of it had seeped into her head. The meeting started, and she listened to the top table discuss the matters of the meeting and pass out news and condolences. A friend of the group had died. From what Agnes could tell, it was the drink that had gotten her. George introduced the newest faces on the top table and asked them to share their story with the group. A thin man with a flat Ouija accent stood up.
"Hiya, my name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic."
His eyes misted as he spoke about how he'd lost contact with his wife, and then how his sons had fallen into first the drink, and then the drugs as well. Agnes listened to the man flattening his vowels, spitting out the story as if he were angry, using short, familiar words that the Glasgow people had made up. She felt she knew him down to his particular tenement because of how he spoke. She didn't wonder at his circumstances, and by the end she felt sorry for him. He would never have been able to escape the weight of his own accent. As they kept talking, she drifted miles away, her insides hurting for a drink. A voice called out,
"You, the black-haired woman in the purple coat."
George was pointing directly at her.
"Would you like to share anything with the group?"
Agnes made to shake her head, no. But instead, she found her legs tightening, and almost involuntarily she stood up. She had done this before, a dozen times in a handful of different chapters. She turned to the left and then her right and gave a small smile. All the faces turned to her, but their features were only blended featureless smudges. A passing worry that the back of her lovely coat was creased from sitting distracted her a moment, and she stumbled over her first words.
Hello, my name is Agnes. And I suppose I am, an alcoholic.
The room made a sound of tepid support.
Welcome, Agnes.
Agnes made to go on, but she found now that the words left her. Her hand ran over the back of the coat trying to smooth any wrinkles. Except for some chronic coughing, the room went silent.
I am in flames, yet I do not burn,
boomed the man's voice.
Sorry?
Said Agnes.
Ego sum in flammis, tamen non adolbit, George said. I am on fire, I do not burn. It's St. Agnes's lament.
Oh.
She was unsure whether she should sit down.
Never a truer word spoken, eh? He continued, finding his footing, addressing their broader fellowship. I am in flames, yet I do not burn. Well, let that be hope for us all. Every one of us here tonight has been ravaged by the flames.
He cleared his throat and spread his arms, like a fairground huckster.
Haven't we all burned for another drink? Burnt up with the fever, with the sweat and panic, our throats on fire, our hearts burning in our chests.
The crowd made an agreeing murmur.
Then you have it.
He made a satisfied, ah, sound.
That glorious drink you have wanted so badly. And it burns through you, as sure as petrol. Like petrol, it fuels the demons in you. It burns you away to the very devil. You go up in flames, and everything you touch, you destroy. Everyone you love steps away, steps back from the fire. Money burns, families burn, careers burn, reputations burn. And then, when it's all burnt, you still burn.
The crowd was rapt.
I cannot tell you how I have watched the flames burn everything I ever had. Even when I was trying to be done with the drink, standing there crying out for help, it was like I was still alight. The great untouchable.
The crowd tuttered in sympathy.
As I reached out for help, everyone shrank back from me. They pulled away from fear that the fire would return. Don't help him, they said. He's no worth it, they said. He'll never change. He'll just pull you down as well.
The handsome man shook his head. The room was quiet now.
Still, at the end it was true, eh? I am in flames, yet I do not burn.
He wiped the spit from the corners of his mouth.
That's what St. Agnes had to teach us. How even in the darkness, there is still hope.
Agnes blinked blindly around the smoky room. She tucked her skirt and coat under her and made to sit down again. The man raised his voice again and pointed at her.
Flames are not just the end. They are also the beginning. For everything that you have destroyed can be rebuilt. From your own ashes you can grow again.
Agnes smiled demurely. She resisted the urge to roll her eyes. The speaker had tried his best to inspire. The meeting went on, and all the fellowship turned to face the front again. Agnes let out a long, low breath. It felt like the first of the evening. There was a comforting hand on her shoulder then, a woman's hand, fine and pale, but the back of it already puffed with the thick blue veins of age. The woman leaned forward to whisper into her ear. She came so close that Agnes could not turn. She could not see her face.
Aye, right enough. The bastards couldn't burn St. Agnes, so they beheaded the poor lassie instead. Fucking men, eh?
The old woman patted her shoulder once, and then, with a cough, she sat back in her seat. Chapter 19. Agnes stepped out of her own ashes in time for Shuggy's 10th birthday. She was off the drink for 3 months before she took up the night shift at the Colliery petrol station. She had spread Christmas over 4 different catalogues, piling the tree with presents and filling the table with 4 kinds of game and meat with no way of paying for any of it. As Leek and Shuggy lay fat and full in the glow of the television, she did not realise she need not have bothered. They were happy with her alone, with her sobriety and the peace it brought. the catalogue bills started to come in. But more than the money, there was something else about the job that she needed then. The job helped with the loneliness. It kept her busy, gave her something to do on the long, empty nights. Without it, she would have sat at home, wondering what she would do until sleep finally came. Most of those nights, she would sit there thinking about Chuck, thinking about the friends who never called anymore, about Lizzie and Willie and about Catherine in South Africa. The night shift helped keep her from the drink. The petrol station doubled as a small shop, the only place for a mile that sold cigarettes, sugary ice lollies, and bags of oven chips. It was a centre of nothing. She pulled a drawer towards herself and lifted out the dirty coins that rattled there, dropped in the change, and pushed packets of fags and pints of milk back through the safety glass partition. It was a social life of sorts, and she was glad for it. Four nights a week, Agnes sat behind the safety glass staring out into the empty darkness. At long intervals, taxi drivers would pull in and fill their black hacks with diesel. Some would ask for the key to the dank little toilet, and some would ask her for a paper and a cold can of iron brew. On either side of the safety glass, they would have their banter about the strikes out of Ravenscraig, about the death of the Clyde, about the shared things in their lives. Taxi drivers were used to being behind glass. Their own nights were partitions and windscreens. Agnes grew glad of their company. Over time, a couple of the men became regular, and a few started to have their breaks there with her, eating sandwiches on either side of the glass. The late-night business at the petrol station improved after she started. Some Hackney drivers went out of their way to call by, to spend 5 minutes with the beautiful woman who laughed at their stories, this doll who seemed always pleased to see them. They moved on only when the next driver pulled up. Sometimes, if she was occupied in conversation, a few of the taxis circled the station until she was free. They watched her like shy wains gawping at a plate of biscuits. She could see them crisscrossing up and down the empty road, waiting for their 10 minutes of peace with her, turning petulant when they saw her laughing with some other driver. Some of the older drivers asked only for the things that were on the low shelves. It was a game for them, to kill the time. Agnes didn't mind. They gabbed away and watched her glide around the small shop, collecting their orders of sugar and starch. They felt less lonely as she bent over to get the day's paper, savouring the tightening of her skirt as she crouched to reach the bottom shelf. They appreciated the way her jumper hung low and the black of her bra was visible against her rose-coloured skin. Agnes knew what a horrible thing it was to be lonely. After a few dark winter months of working in the station, things started coming to Agnes. At first it was small things, like boxes of potatoes or extra jars of pickled onions from the cash and carry. One morning, she was given a shipping box of panty liners. Soon, a couple of the drivers started bringing bigger presents, like a used fridge, an old portable television, and other electronics that had come off the backs of lorries. Chuggy had come home from school and found the cracked draft door reglazed. He had come home and found the mouldy kitchenette freshly painted. Towards the dead end of the night shift, there were whole stretches of time when no one would stop in at the garage. Agnes would sit and stare out at the pit road, counting the hours by watching the back and forth of the lonely night bus. These nights, she would sit behind her safety glass and slowly flick through her Freeman's catalogue, spending wages before they were earned. The sun would creep up, and she would get ready for the shift to be over, slipping a bar of chocolate into her pocket for the way in school and helping herself to a fly packet of cigarettes. She'd open the lock on the door and let the morning shift in. As she walked the road back to Pithead, the morning sun would set the slag hills on fire before the heavy sky had a chance to roll in and cover the scheme in its usual grey blanket. On the way home, Agnes would sing a polite good morning as she passed the tired bones of the women with cleaning jobs in the city. The cleaners would rub the gold crosses that hung around their necks and mutter a quiet, aye, without looking at her. What a respectable Catholic was doing coming home at that ungodly hour, these thin women could not fathom. They were suspicious of this woman, who wore lipstick in the early morning and unchipped nail polish the colour of sex. The men who were lucky enough to still have jobs would look up and smile as they passed Agnes. They tried to hide the wrapped lunches that their wives had made as they wished her a good morning, gave her a sly wink. When she got home, she would slip the stolen chocolate bar under Shuggy's pillow, and with a kiss and a cup of milky tea, she would wake him for school. At the foot of Leek's bed, she would leave his overalls, clean and washed from the night before. The boys would lie in separate beds, silently facing each other, listening to the sound of her singing along to the morning radio. Neither of them would blink, scared to be the first to break the spell. Agnes had been working the night shift for only a couple of months when she first met him, the red-headed ox. He was different from the others. The other taxi drivers had taken on that familiar shape of men past their prime, the hours spent sedentary behind the wheel causing the collapse of their bodies, the full Scottish breakfast and the snack bar suppers settling like cooled porridge around their waists. Eventually, the taxi hunched them over till their shoulders rounded into a soft hump and their heads jutted forward on jowled necks. The ones who had been at the night shift a long time had turned ghostly pale. Their only colour was the faint rosacea from the years of drink. These were the men who decorated their fingers with gold sovereign rings, taking vain pleasure from watching them sit high and shiny on the steering wheel. This could not help but remind her of Shug. When the redhead first stepped from his taxi, she tried not to stare. He must have been new to the driving. His shoulders were still straight, and the pink in his face was from daylight and fresh air, not dark pubs and golden pints of stout. He was a tall, broad man, and as he filled the taxi with diesel, she watched how he stood straight and proud. He rocked the taxi side to side with one thick arm, his red curls shining under the flickering fluorescent lights. He didn't flinch when he saw her, as the other men sometimes did, but he didn't smile either. She was sat behind her glass, her arms folded, as if she was waiting for a lover who had forgotten to come and pick her up. She pushed his change towards him in the little safety drawer, and he mumbled thanks and went back to his taxi. It was a few weeks before he turned up again. This time she was talking to him before he had even reached the window. "You've not been driving long, have you?" she said, with a lipstick smile, the drawer pushed out towards him invitingly.
"Excuse me," he said, shaken from his thoughts. "I can't hear you from behind that glass."
Agnes took in the broad Scots, the soft song of Strathclyde in his voice. She went on in the Queen's best.
"I was just asking if you're new to driving taxis."
"What makes you ask a man that?"
he asked pointedly, his breath warm on the cold glass.
Agnes's smile cracked. "It's just, I get a lot of taxi drivers pass through here. You seem more cheerful than the rest."
He looked at her much as he might a talking dog. She fumbled on.
"You know, you just seem less jaded by it. All that driving. All those difficult passengers."
"Do you think you're a good judge of character, then?"
The question took Agnes by surprise. It was her that was silent now. The redhead dropped some coins in the drawer with a loud tinny clang.
"Give us a pint of milk and a white loaf. Pan bread, not plain. Make sure it's fresh, and don't squash it flat in your contraption."
He pointed at her security drawer. It took her a moment to recover and get up out of her chair. She was halfway across the little shop before she looked back to see whether he was watching. But the redhead was staring at his feet as though there were a story written on his shoes. He breathed in through his horse-like nose, and she watched his shoulders rise and spread and then fall again. He looked tired, sick and tired. Returning to the window, she placed the small milk bottle in the drawer and slid it through to him. He took it up in his big paw. She dropped the loaf in the drawer, and it was only then that he spoke again.
"You'll squash my loaf."
Agnes looked up at him, dumbstruck. The loaf would fit with a push, but he protested again, his cheeks turning pink.
"I'm telling you, don't shove that through there."
"It'll be all right. The bread's springy."
She pushed her fingers against the moist loaf, and as if it were an advert for freshness, the loaf sprang back. The man was silent. Agnes smiled coyly.
"Well, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't open the security door."
She placed her hand on her chest and opened her eyes wide.
"You see, I'm here all by myself."
The redhead moved from one foot to the other, his cheeks flushed red. He blinked and looked at his feet and took a hard lungful through his big nostrils.
"Look, do you want this loaf or not?"
asked Agnes, leaning close to the glass. The front of her jumper shifted, and she knew the black strap of her bra would be on her shoulder. She smiled through half-lidded eyes. He slammed his thick fist on the glass. It made her leap back as if she had been slapped.
"Mother of God, can an honest man no get a flat fucking bit of toast?"
This brought out the demon in Agnes. It did her morale no good to feel so invisible. To be ignored like this made her want a taste of the drink. With a painted fingernail, she slipped open the glued end of the loaf and drew out the doorstep slice. She dropped it into the drawer pan like a dead fish. She pushed the single slice towards the big man. He looked down into the drawer at the loaf slice, like she had shat in a box.
"Well, take it then," she warned.
The smile and the bra strap were gone. The redhead drew up the slice and held it tenderly. With a metal zip, the drawer drew back in sight. Agnes deposited another slice and pushed it through to him. The man drew it up. They went on in silence, Agnes dropping slices of pan loaf into the drawer and the man gathering them up delicately, like china dishes. She was sure he hadn't breathed since the first slice had slid towards him. Somewhere inside him, the air hissed out like a burst tire, and he looked down at the half loaf in his arms. Agnes kept working the drawer.
"I used to work down the pit till they shut it,"
he said quietly.
"How could you tell I wasn't a driver?"
"I could just tell," said Agnes. "I've had experience."
"Uh-huh.
I could write a book."
She slipped another slice into the tray.
"I don't know how they do it," said the red-headed man. "And the people you meet, every manner of scoundrel."
"It takes a certain kind of person to be out here at night. Have you been on the night shift long?"
"About a month."
"It's awful lonely, isn't it?"
said Agnes. The man looked at her for what seemed like the first time.
"Aye, it's very lonely," he said.
His eyes were tired. She slid the last doorstep slice towards him.
"Well, come by tomorrow night. I'll feed a box of cornflakes through this drawer to you."
The man smiled for the first time. His teeth were big and straight and white.
"Okay."
"Mind and bring a plastic bag, 'cause I'm giving it flake by flake."
Since Shug, there had been other men, but there had been no nights out. All day she had waited for the taxi horn. She had taken her bath by lunchtime and still had to wait until 8 o'clock when he said he would call for her. The clock radio blinked its neon numbers like a countdown. Agnes swung all day from feverish to despondent, and now, waiting in front of the vanity mirror, she felt increasingly stupid. In her mind, she made a list of all the things she mustn't tell this new man. The bad things better left untold made her throat feel choked. It called out for a drink. Shuggy sat in thoughtful silence next to her, his hands patiently on his lap. His ankles crossed neatly, with the same look of pained nerves on his face. Agnes tried to tidy her life into a narrative and felt increasingly dull and flat. The things she couldn't speak about left her with yawning gaps. They shaped her into a woman who had been asleep since 1967, the year she had met Shug. The red-headed ox was called Eugene. It was a good name, both old-fashioned and plain. It was a name mothers chose for firstborn sons, the ones that were to be solid and true, mother's pride, but not her joy. It had always seemed to Agnes that it was the name Catholic mothers gave to the sons who were for the priesthood, the children marked like a tithe offering. Eugene pumped the horn of the black hack, and Agnes jumped with nerves. Small perfume bottles tinkled lightly on the night table. She looked down at the boy, who had crossed his fingers for good luck. He held them up and shook them at her with a hopeful smile. Leek leaned in the doorway, his arms folded across himself. She asked him for a kiss for luck, and Shuggy watched as she put her arms around his neck. At first, Leek didn't move, and then very slowly, he unfurled and held her in his arms. He showered her cheeks with kisses until, giggling like a schoolgirl, she had to push him away and check he hadn't ruined her blush. Outside in the soft evening light, she saw again how handsome the man was. In a wide lapelled suit and with his thick hair combed wet through, he made the old hackney seem like a Rolls Royce. Eugene opened the driver's door and stepped out. Agnes saw his thin bolo tie, his tie pin gleaming proudly. This was, she realised, the first time they hadn't been separated by safety glass. He opened the back passenger door for her, and without looking up, she knew the pit women were all stewing at their front windows. She felt the breeze of a thousand net curtains twitching. With a ringed hand, she pushed her hair from her face and threw her head high. She could almost hear the angry slapping of gums. "Did you find it okay then?" she asked, as he closed the door behind her.
"Aye, no problem at all," he said, starting the engine. "Did I keep you waiting?"
"No, no. I was in a real rush to get ready. The day just flew by."
She tried to sprinkle her words with a light, casual laugh.
"Well, you look the part."
He eyed her approvingly in his mirror.
"Oh, that's a relief," she said,
lifting her arms and letting the leather tassels on the sleeves shake.
"I had no idea what to wear."
Agnes had never been to the Grand Old Opry before. It sat on the south side of Glasgow, on the Govan Road, an old converted picture hall in a decaying part of town. Couples went for the country music nights, with line dancing and gunslinging matches. It might have been the good crack of the country music, or it might have been the guns. But somehow the Opry appealed deeply to Glaswegians. Any night of the week, it was rampacked. For a few hours, Edna McCluskey from Clarkston could become Kentucky Belle, while her man, Wee Stan, would slip into a leather waistcoat and a big tasselled Stetson and become Stagecoach Stan the Bounty Man. Eugene parked and helped Agnes down from her carriage. The Opry's old western sign lit up the street and shone off the wet tarmac. People jostled at the door to get in,
and Agnes had the impression of being at a fancy premiere. Eugene cut to the front of the queue, gave a flash of his shiny silver sheriff's badge, and they walked right in. Inside, it barely resembled the picture house it had once been. It was laid out over two levels, with a big stage at the front. On the stage was a band, the singer in tan-coloured leather chaps, his hair swept up into a rockabilly quiff over his pockmarked face. He held the mic stand against his legs, as if it were the girl he was in love with. He sang with a thick Johnny Cash twang. In front of the stage was a small dance floor, where some older couples were doing a hurdy-gurdy version of a hoedown. Old men in tight denim swung thick-armed housewives around, and they looked like they were having a rare time as they locked arms and two-stepped in time to the band. The Opry women wore either cowgirl outfits with Stetson hats or big flouncy harlot's dresses with lace trim and feathers in their hair. Agnes looked down at her tight black skirt and leather coat. It had cost a fortune from the catalogue. She'd sent it back twice to get the fit just right. Now she looked around the room at the denims and the ruffled dresses, and she hated the outfit. Eugene led her through the crowd. He had leather boots on, and under his tan suit jacket he had a gun belt with a decorative tooled holster holding a shiny pistol on each side. Heads nodded familiarly at him, and he nodded stiffly back. Around the dance floor were small round-top tables where the younger couple sat, not yet drunk enough to take up dancing unabashedly. Eugene pulled out a chair and sat Agnes down in the dead centre of the room, not tucked away in some corner. He took her coat, and she let him linger, his thick hands on her shoulders, just long enough to breathe in the perfume of her hair. The place was alive with the infectious rattle of the band and the stepping, bouncing dance. The air was thick with the warm smells of golden whiskey and leather. It was early still, but the crowd was already carried away. Agnes thought it was funny how a bit of cheap dress-up could be so liberating.
"What do you make of it, then?" asked Eugene, his face wearing a wide, proud grin.
"It's marvellous, isn't it?"
"It really is. Glasgow was the original Wild West, you know. You can still get scalped out on Maryhill Road in a weeknight."
Eugene was relaxing into his element.
"I'm glad we could finally get to do this."
"Me too."
"I realised tonight was the first time I could be sure you had actual legs," he laughed. "That you weren't just some petrol station stool from the waist down."
"I hope you're not disappointed."
"No, no."
Eugene laughed and held out his paw as way of a formal introduction.
"Nice to meet you. Tell me a wee bit about yourself."
"Not much to tell."
Agnes lifted a wet beer coaster and started to spin it nervously. She unfolded the narrative she had practiced in her head.
"Glasgow papist, born and bred. It's been a quiet life."
"Aye, me too."
"I'm a divorcee,"
Agnes added quickly, liking the way it sounded better than, "My man left me for a plain-faced dowdy whore." Eugene paused. It felt to her like a second too long.
"Could you not make it work?"
asked the Catholic. Was he disappointed? Agnes couldn't tell. She shook her head and was relieved when, with a jangling of spurs, a waitress appeared at the side of their table. She was a pretty enough woman, dressed in tight, light-coloured jeans and a big rattlesnake belt. The snake's head still attached, its rattle rammed in its own mouth as a closure.
"Why, hello there, Sheriff. How's life been a-treating you?"
She spoke in a broad Texan twang by way of the sharp end of the gorbals.
"Hiya, Belle. Can't I complain?"
Eugene held his hand out towards Agnes.
"This is my friend Agnes. This is our first time."
Without smiling, Belle nodded her big hat in Agnes's direction. It was a cold greeting.
"So, Sheriff, you riding that new stagecoach of yours around this wild city?"
"Aye, unfortunately."
"Well, any one of these days, I'm going to persuade you to come and rustle me up.
She went on, in pure Hollywood Texan, leaning close, her shirt splitting open at the chest.
Maybe we could take a little run out to Burn Island. My niece has a caravan by the water.
Agnes wondered whether they had seaside caravans in Texas. She giggled. She couldn't help it. The waitress looked down at her like she was a pest.
Maybe another time, eh?
Eugene shifted in his seat. Belle sighed and stuck a thumb in her belt loop.
Well, what'll it be, pal?
Her accent was now flat south side.
I'll have a pint and a half.
He looked over to Agnes.
I'll just have a Coca-Cola,
said Agnes. She was dry-mouthed over the moment she had dreaded all day.
Is that it? And some lemon,
added Agnes, as breezily as she could.
Coming right up.
The woman sighed and jangled away, taking care to swing her arse like a fattened heifer. Agnes watched Eugene's face. She was glad he didn't steal a glance.
Well, she seems nice.
I suppose, said Eugene, unconvincingly.
That's a very pretty name, Belle.
Aye, it is. Shame her real name is Geraldine.
Agnes laughed.
Is that right then, Sheriff?
Eugene let her laugh at him. It was generous, and it made her relax a little.
Aye, that's Geraldine from Gart Cosh, and I'm not entirely sure she didn't kill that snake and make that belt herself.
I better watch myself then.
Aye, that woman could make new boots out of an old husband.
The drinks came, and they sat watching the line dancers swing each other around and around for a while before he turned back to her.
So why are you no taking a drink?
Agnes scanned the story of the cleaned-up version of her life.
Oh, you know, drink doesn't agree with me. Gives me a terrible head in the morning.
She scratched the back of her neck nervously. Eugene seemed as if he was not going to accept the lie. The flicker of recognition flashed between them.
I will. Maybe later.
Maybe.
She tried to change the subject.
So anyway, how come the town sheriff is still single?
I was just going to ask you the same thing.
That's a long story. You remember those boots made out of husbands?
What? Should I be careful then?
Well, some say I'm a divorcee looking for a matching purse.
She sucked in the little straw.
So go on. Answer my question.
It took a while for him to answer. He took a sip of the lager and a mouthful of the whiskey.
Well, I was married for a very long time. Up until last year, actually. The big C. Quite sudden.
I'm sorry to hear that.
She laid her hand on his.
Same thing did my father in.
He only nodded and took another mouthful of each of the drinks. The sweat on the side of his lager looked refreshing. The country music wound down, and the band told the crowd they would take a break. A sweaty couple came over, the woman in a brothel dress and the man in a standard cowboy rig.
Hiya, Sheriff. How's it going?
Said the woman, as honky-tonk as you could get from Glasgow. Eugene introduced the couple as Leslie and Leslie, couple of regulars. Leslie said,
If you see my wife, don't tell her I'm here with my young bird.
The little man smiled a ferrety grin.
Gaze piece, like I've no heard that afore.
His wife rolled her eyes, bored after years of the same nonsense.
We just wanted to come over and see how you were doing, Sheriff.
Leslie folded her mutton arms under her big chest and took her crucifix between her fingers.
How are you bearing up?
Well enough.
Eugene looked a little cornered.
We're still praying for you up the chapel, said Leslie. Feels like yesterday, doesn't it?
Aye,
said Eugene. He glanced nervously at Agnes.
God lover and keeper.
Leslie twisted her cross. Eugene lifted his whiskey in salute, but didn't drink. Agnes watched Leslie. The woman was studying Eugene, her eyes moving from his hair to his mended waistcoat buttons to the collar of his shirt, bleached clean and starched. She was one of those women who lived in details. Who was ironing his shirt? Who was feeding him?
"How's your sisters?"
she asked finally.
"Aye, fine enough," he said. "I might be the eldest, but you wouldn't credit it to watch them in action. They could patronise Methuselah."
"Ach, they'll only be worried about you. Tell your Colleen I was asking for her in the wains, will you? Terrible mess we are, Jamesy. Tell her I'm sending some old clothes over for them. Our Gerald's taking another stretch, growing like a weed. I don't know how your Colleen closed 5 of them since that pit shut."
Eugene sat stock still, his whisky glass still half raised. It took Agnes a moment, but when the penny dropped, her smile began to crack.
"That place is going to the dogs since that colliery shut. I heard all about the Valium nonsense. Oh, and I heard about that Alky Hoor that's moved in across the street."
She turned to Agnes, expecting some solidarity between women.
"In my day, the chapel would have moved someone like that along. It's no right having a woman like that among good families."
At that, the ferrety cowboy rolled his eyes and took his wife's pillowy arm. He half dragged her back to the dance floor.
"I will. Cheerio then,"
said the woman brightly, and she turned to Agnes.
"Lovely to meet you, darling."
Agnes nodded, but her eyes were already glassy, black eyeliner threatening to return to liquid form. After the Leslies left, she and Eugene were quiet a long while. Then Agnes spoke.
"So, are you all laughing at me?"
"No."
Eugene shook his tangle of red curls like an earnest child.
"Not me."
"Everyone is laughing at me," she said, mostly to herself. "It must be a big joke to you."
"No,"
he said again. His broad pink palms lay face up on the tabletop, like Shug's always had, a con artist trying to appear sincere. Agnes watched the hands rest there and gulped down the poor me's that wanted him to hurt her, the part of her that longed for the expected.
"So what exactly is Colleen McAvaney to you? You all loop around so much I wouldn't be surprised if she was your cousin, your sister and your milkman at the same time."
Eugene sighed.
"You asked me if I found your house all right, and I said yes. Well, I wasn't very clear."
He took a slow mouthful of the beer, a quick mouthful of the whiskey, and lay his palms open again.
"Colleen McAvaney is my baby sister."
The happy noises in the room stopped. Agnes could feel the Leslies surely looking at her. Their thin eyes branded her with the familiar burn of shame on the side of her face, on the hem of her skirt, on the rings on her fingers. She let the words sink in. The amber lager called her name. It said it would make it all better. She realised that Eugene was talking again.
"Our Colleen is only one of 8 of us, all living on that scheme. Good Irish stock. You know how it can be. Our granda was one of the first miners, and we all grew up and sort of stayed on. They didn't think much of imagination in their days."
He tried a warm smile. She was not to be thawed.
"So, what does she say about me?"
asked Agnes, straightening her spine.
"Och, don't worry about her. She says too much about every fucking thing."
His open palms closed into balls.
"Well, anyway, I can imagine."
"It's just a small place," soothed Eugene.
"I'm a bad drunk."
"And there's nothing today."
"And I'm a bad mother."
"Where everyone knows everyone's business."
"I make a right show of myself."
"And should mind their own."
"And I am a filthy whore."
At that last word, he shifted awkwardly in his seat. The good Catholic, the firstborn, solid and true.
I see,
she said quietly. I have to ask, he said after a moment. I mean, I'm very sorry to ask you this.
She watched his thick neck twitch